I don't know about you, but I'm having a bit of a hard time these days cutting through all the post-election bitterness and negativity. So for a change, here's a story about hope and idealism that didn't crash and burn. It's a story about a guy who went looking for enlightenment and wound up helping to eliminate one of the worst diseases in history. His name is Larry Brilliant. He's a doctor, and he's one of the key players in the fight to defeat smallpox. In fact, he presided over the last known cases. He also founded a nonprofit that cured more than 2 million cases of blindness. But none of this is how he started out. In his new memoir, Sometimes Brilliant, Larry tells the story of how, as a young man, he got swept up in that whole summer of love, psychedelic hippie thing. And eventually he landed in the Himalayas at an Indian ashram, where his guru told him that his destiny was to cure smallpox. As Larry told Steve Paulson, his whole life has been a series of unlikely events, starting with becoming a hippie.
Well, I was from Detroit, Michigan, which I think explains that I hadn't seen very much of the coasts. And I certainly was unprepared for what I would see in the summer of love in San Francisco. And it really wasn't fair to do to a young boy like me from Detroit, Michigan. And I didn't resist, I have to confess. It was like opening up a candy box to a kid. And that candy box was freedom and self-expression, playfulness, a sense of humor, a little bit too much hedonism.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll is what you're talking about,
sex,
right?
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, without any question. And it was amazing. And it wasn't just hedonism, hedonism, hedonism. It was, this is the beginning of the age of Aquarius. This is a time of freedom and justice and partying. To top it all off, I was there during the summer as a government employee, and I had a job, which was to check hospitals for discrimination. But indeed, that was my day job. At night, my job was to understand the counterculture. You're quite right about that.
Mm. So you basically became a hippie doctor.
I hadn't yet become a hippie doctor. That happened when I met Wavy Gravy.
Wavy Gravy, the famous sort of clown prince of the counterculture.
Yes. Then my transformation from activist to hippie was complete.
So for people who've never heard of Wavy Gravy, can you describe this man? Because he really sounds like one of a kind.
He was on the bus and part of the Merry Pranksters. He then started his own commune, kind of a parallel to Ken Kesey's commune called the Hog Farm. And the Hog Farm was invited to go to Woodstock and to provide food. And the clown persona is just his way of getting around in costume.
Of disarming people, too, right? I mean, he's always been an activist, but he wanted to get people to drop their defenses.
Yeah, Wavy doesn't have any enemies. You're not going to find people who say, let's go out and beat up Wavy Gravy. That's just not the way it works.
So you met a lot of the icons of the 60s. Ken Kesey, Tim Leary, the apostle of LSD, Richard Alpert, Leary's one-time Harvard colleague, later became Ram Dass. It must have been pretty heady stuff.
Yeah, you're talking about my friends now. You know, certainly Ram Dass, and my wife and I lived in the same ashram that he lived in the Himalayas. We were taken by his book, Be Here Now. Ken Kesey stayed in my apartment in San Francisco many times. And of course, Tim Leary, who was Richard Alpert's colleague.
Now, how did psychedelics figure into that whole scene? LSD, psilocybin, and the other stuff that was going around.
Well, I think it was part of the water we drank just about. And it was certainly on the Medicine Ball Caravan, on this movie, which was the only time I took LSD and psilocybin in large quantities over a very intense period of time. It was part of the caravan. And it was an amazing time for me.
Did that change you?
Yeah, it definitely changed me. It made me unable to go down the road that I was going down as an activist. You know, the peace march, the nonviolence, was leading into a violent kind of anti-war. The SDS becoming the weatherman, that transition, I couldn't go there. I couldn't see how people would pick up guns.
Now, you and your wife, Elaine, she later changed her name, but you joined Wavy Gravy on the Hog Farm bus, and it was quite an odyssey, at least as you write about it. What was this all about, this bus trip?
Well, first of all, we had an expression in those days, you're either on the bus or you're off the bus. We were really on the bus, there's no question. And Wavy and the Hog Farm, that we were not formally part of at that point, decided they wanted to continue on the road and buy another bus, turned out to be two buses, and drive from London through Europe and Turkey and Iran and Afghanistan and Iraq and into Pakistan and India and up either to Nepal or to go to Bangladesh, which Wavy thought we should do to bring food and medical supplies to people who had been devastated by a cyclone in 1972. And Girich and I, my wife Elaine and I, traveled with the bus from Istanbul to Kathmandu. And that was an amazing experience.
Now, to jump ahead in the story a little bit. So you've already had your taste of India, and you end up going back to India. Your wife has spent a lot of time at an ashram with the famous Hindu spiritual guru, Neem Karoli Baba. And you end up going there as well. How did that happen?
My wife decided that she wanted to find the guru of Baba Ramdas, Neem Karoli Baba. And so she had gone to his ashram, and war had broken out between India and Pakistan, and we could not communicate with each other very well. Phone calls were difficult to come by. Telegrams were often misinterpreted. She would say in her telegrams to me, come here immediately, and I would get back telegrams that seemed to say, I am living with another man, and the part about him being a guru and Neem Karoli Baba wasn't all that clear. So our communication was a little complicated, and in the end we negotiated a settlement that she would come back to San Francisco for Christmas, and I would pledge to go back to India with her to meet this man, Neem Karoli Baba. And we went to live for what turned out to be a couple of years.
But when you first got there, I mean, your wife was totally committed. I mean, this is what she wanted to do with her life. And you say that it was a hard landing for you. I mean, you thought you were going to have this amazing transformative experience. As soon as you got there, you didn't.
No, that's right. I knew I wanted to find something that would change me into a better person spiritually. I'd been reading the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Bhagavad Gita, but I hadn't found the right thing for me, and I was so hoping that by going back and staying in this ashram that had, where Ramdas had been changed and so many others, that I too would become changed. But the first couple of weeks there, the scene seemed pagan to me. There were all these idols, these young Americans that were touching this old man's feet. I mean, it just seemed like I was not destined to be part. I thought it was a cult. I thought my wife had been captured by a cult.
And the way you write about this is, I mean, when things weren't working out with you there, they weren't working out in your marriage as well. I mean, it looked like
that's right.
Things were going to fall
that's
apart.
Right. Oh, because if my wife had to choose between her guru and me, there was no contest. And I loved her very much, and I didn't want to lose her. And I had my own dark night of the soul, except it was during the day. And I went out on a lake near the ashram in Nainital. I started thinking about God. I think I recited every prayer that I'd ever learned, whether it was Hebrew or whether it was Tibetan, Sanskrit, or I was trying to find a way to get a sign that it was the right place for me to stay. But I got nothing back. I was bargaining with God. I mean, just give me an oil slick with a little rainbow in the oil slick. Nobody else needs to see it. I'll take that. But nothing. I thought, she's been captured by a cult, and it isn't my cult.
So you were going to leave at that point?
I packed my bags. We cried. We hugged. The next morning, she said, you're leaving, but would you at least go and say goodbye to him? And I said, yeah, I'll go say goodbye to him. And we packed everything in a taxi, and we went down to the ashram, and I told the taxi driver to wait, and we went in to say goodbye to him. And he was in his room, and there was a, we call it a tucket. It was just a wooden cot that he would sit on, and it had a little blanket on it. And the villagers who adored him, who worshiped him, who venerated him, had made a what's called a mandala out of flowers and fruits. They had brought them in. It's a, like a drawing. But they had, instead of a drawing, they had written the name of Ram, which is the name of God, Ram. And they had made the name of Ram out of apples and oranges and flower petals. And one of the apples had fallen down. It had rolled off the cot. And so I reached down to pick up the apple to put it back on the tucket to complete the name of God. And Neem Karoli Baba, who we called Maharaji, he burst out of his room. He saw me. He saw my hand on the ground picking up the apple, and he stepped on my hand. And all of a sudden, my worst nightmare, I was touching his feet, and I couldn't get my hand out from under his foot. And he pinned me down there, and he started to laugh. And he said, and it's the first time he had ever said anything to me. I'd been there for more than a week. He never even noticed me. And now he looked at me, he said, "You weren't here yesterday." And, you know, it's an awkward position to be down on your knees.
Yeah. You just want to get the hell out of there, right?
I couldn't, you know, I couldn't get the apple out of my hand. He's standing on my hand. "You were not here yesterday." I said, "That's true, yeah." He's speaking Hindi, which I understand a little bit of. And then he said, "You weren't here yesterday. Were you sick?" "No, you weren't sick." And he's talking to himself. He said, "Were you flying a kite?" "No, you weren't flying a kite." "Were you swimming in the lake?" And I'm thinking, that's the most polluted lake on the planet. He's not really seriously. He said, "No, no, you were at the lake, but you weren't swimming. What were you doing at the lake?" And up until now, he'd only spoken in Hindi, but lake he said in English, and I felt a kind of shudder in my back. And then he looked down at me and says, "What were you doing at the lake yesterday? Oh, yes, you were talking to God. Did you ask for a sign?" And he said that in English. And when he said it, it was like everything in my life had pointed towards that moment, and I started to cry. And I mean, I'm a scientist. There was nothing in my rational mind or in my science training that could explain that he knew that I was. I mean, I hadn't told him. I hadn't even told my wife.
You hadn't told your wife that what you had done out on the lake.
No, I hadn't told anybody. And certainly nobody knew I'd been trying to recite every prayer I had memorized in every different language so a sign would appear. And then he released my hand, and he started rubbing my beard. I was crying, and he was wiping away my tears. And he said, "Dr. America." That was the name he gave me, Dr. America. I mean, they say in all the ancient texts that the teacher will initiate you. I had some idea. You'd walk into a room, put a robe on, and you'd do some incantation. There'd be candles and, you know, some part. This was my initiation.
How do you explain that? I mean, how do you explain that he knew this dark night of the soul or dark day of the soul for you, and that, you know, you'd lost hope and this was the moment that he was going to reach out to you?
I can't explain it, nor can I explain how years later he told me out of the blue that I would be transformed yet again from Dr. America into UNO doctor and work for the United Nations and work to help to eradicate smallpox. I mean, maybe somebody could have seen me on the lake. That's possible.
But you don't believe conjecture. That. I mean, you something else.
No, I don't believe it, but I try to honestly answer the question, what do I think happened? I don't know. But I don't think it's the magic part or the, you know, ascribing superpowers to him part, or that is the least bit interesting to me. How he captured my heart was that when I sat in front of him and he was talking about the lake and maybe reading my mind, I don't know, I knew that he loved everybody in the world. I could feel the love coming from him. But it was not a surprise to me that he loved everybody in the world. He was supposed to. That was his job. But what had happened in that moment was that I felt that I loved everybody in the world. And I had never felt like I loved everybody in the world. To me, there were cops and there were marchers. There were soldiers and there were Vietnamese. Everything had been binary. But in that moment, and in many moments since then, I don't feel like there's anyone I hate. And that was not something that I was prepared for.
Yeah.
And that is the reason that I stayed.
Larry Brilliant went on to join the World Health Organization team in India that eradicated the world's remaining cases of smallpox. You can hear that story and more in an extended version of Steve's interview on our website at ttbook.org. Brilliant later became the first executive director of google.org, and his memoir is called Sometimes Brilliant. That's it for the show today, but there's always more in our podcast feed. To sign up, visit iTunes or Stitcher. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Raymond Tangakar, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mark Rickers. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walkwest Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.